a tradition that's deeply interested in Jesus as a historical figure, understanding him in his historical context, thinking critically about who he actually was. Historical Jesus scholarship and traditional Christianity are two rival traditions of historical inquiry. If it's a humanities discipline, then it's putting human beings into contact with reality from the past so that they themselves might be changed.
Hello and welcome to Faith at the Frontiers, a podcast that confronts challenges to the Christian faith with hope. This episode brings to a close our thoughts on the Bible and history, and it does so in a very special way, by celebrating the publication of our own Austin Stevenson's book on that very subject. That's right, one of the podcast hosts has written a book, and you can learn a bit about it for free right here. So stay tuned, and I hope you enjoy listening. So, in this episode, it's just me and Austin. Hi, Austin.
Hello, good to see you.
Yeah, you too. And so this is going to be our last episode on the historical challenges relating to the Bible. We're going to move on and talk about other historical challenges that the Christian faith faces going forward. But to wrap up this part of our series on the Bible, we are going to, I'm going to interview Austin himself. So Austin is not the host today. Austin is our guest speaker.
That's right.
How does that make you feel, Austin?
Yeah, it's exciting. Maybe intimidating. I get to see how it feels on the other side.
Yeah. And as our guest speaker, I'm going to interview you on your book, which was just published. Was it this month, Austin?
Yeah, that's right. Well, just at the end of March.
At the end of March. So last month, very fresh new book. What's it called?
So it's called The Consciousness of the Historical Jesus, Historiography, Theology, and Metaphysics with T&T Clark.
Wow. The Consciousness of the Historical Jesus. And it seems to me, I mean, obviously, I've read some of this book already and I've engaged with your stuff. It seems to me that your title has a wordplay in it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so in some ways, the title is signaling a body of scholarship that talks in those terms, but it's also going to kind of challenge the use of that term particularly. So a lot of the book is actually challenging, the role that consciousness has played in these kinds of questions. It's going to redefine it, but broadly asking questions about who did Jesus think he was? What was he intending to do with his characteristic words and actions? And what are the deeper questions involved in asking that kind of question about someone from the past?
It's also our consciousness of the historical Jesus, right?
Yes, that's right. So, yeah,
how it's do we... Jesus's consciousness and our consciousness. That's the wordplay, right?
Yep, absolutely. So all of those things are involved.
So can I just start off by quoting, not from your book, but from a book that many of our listeners may have already read, C.S. Lewis's The Screwtape Letters.
Yeah.
So C.S. Lewis says in The Screwtape Letters, "The historical Jesus, then, however dangerous he may seem to be to us, is always to be encouraged." Now, C.S. Lewis is writing from the perspective of a demon, advising another demon on how to lead Christians astray. So to say that the historical Jesus is to be encouraged really means that C.S. Lewis is not a fan of the idea of the historical Jesus.
That's right.
Why would C.S. Lewis not be a fan in 1942? Why would C.S. Lewis not be a fan of this term, the historical Jesus? I mean, from an ordinary listener's perspective, it sounds quite an innocent term. Like, we believe that Jesus was alive in history. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, why wouldn't you want to believe in that Jesus is a historical figure? The discipline of historical Jesus studies has a very particular history, and they sort of own that term, the historical Jesus, which is not just about saying Jesus existed in the past, and we're interested in that, but Jesus, as he can be reconstructed by modern historical critical methods, is what that term comes to mean, right? So what can academic scholars using a particular set of methods sort of prove or discover or reconstruct about this figure who stands behind the Gospels? And in the history of that scholarship, it basically begins as a discipline trying to take down kind of historic Christian beliefs about Jesus and challenge them. And so it sits very uncomfortably with, say, Christian theology and the church from pretty much from the beginning.
So like traditional or Orthodox Christians would always be a bit suspicious of these, of the term historical Jesus back then, because it implied a way of doing research about the Gospels, which actually undermines some of the historical elements of them, right? Is that right?
That's right. That's right. So they would often start by saying, you know, historic Orthodox Christianity says this about Jesus, but that can't be true for these reasons. And here's an alternative story about who Jesus actually was. That's very much at the heart of this scholarship, particularly through the kind of early beginnings, kind of late 18th into the 19th century and early 20th century as well.
Okay, so we can sort of see why C.S. Lewis would be warning his readers back in 1942 against the historical Jesus. But do you share that same view now? Do you think we should all avoid the historical Jesus?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think part of what I'm trying to do is say, okay, actually the phrase the historical Jesus means multiple things, right? So we, I think as Christians, absolutely need to care about the historical person Jesus, about the reality that he lived and what he did and what he said. I think that matters immensely for Christianity. It's my perspective that if that is a myth, that that didn't happen, that Christianity crumbles if that's the case, but also that this isn't simply a set of stories or ideas, but that the actual historical context in which it happened matters as well, right? So recognizing that Jesus was speaking to a particular group of people at a particular time and place, and that we need to understand that in order to get at what he was saying, what he was doing. I think all of that matters immensely for us. But I don't necessarily think that what has counted as the historical Jesus in terms of critical scholarship is the same thing as that. And so I'm asking critical questions about the difference between those, but about basically what counts as a historical perspective on Jesus and why.
Okay, so you're putting up this historical Jesus tradition, you're putting it to scrutiny, you're analyzing it and analyzing. Well, what are you analyzing about it? Let me ask you that.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about if historical Jesus scholarship is about applying a certain set of critical historical methods to the data that we have about Jesus and kind of reconstructing him as a historical figure, the questions I'm asking are, where did those methods come from? What do those methods assume about really basic questions about reality, about human persons? And how is that impacting then what they say about Jesus? Because one of the things about Christian theology is that we have a set of beliefs, both theological beliefs and philosophical arguments about mm-hmm. the nature of reality, about the nature of human persons. Mm-hmm. And the crux of my argument is really to say that actually those are very much at odds with the kinds of claims that are built into these historical methods being employed by historical Jesus scholars.
All right. So I mean, that's a claim that I think most people who would consider themselves historical Jesus scholars, they would not be that happy with, right? If I was a historical Jesus scholar, I'd probably say, look, the whole point of my research is to get rid of all of these dogmas and traditional preconceptions about Jesus and just look at the actual history so that I can get to the sort of objective facts about what Jesus did and said. And it seems to me that you're saying I'm not doing that.
Exactly. So that's the thing, is that I think we would love if we could have a set of scientific methods that objectively allowed us to know for a fact what is and is not the case about Jesus and reconstruct without any semblance of subjectivity or tradition or debatable assumptions and questions what is the case. I think that's laudable. That's something we would all love to do. And that's something that these scholars often suggest that they're doing. They don't always do this, but they kind of talk this way, or something they want. But what I'm arguing, and what many of others have argued, particularly on this, is that that's not possible. At least at the moment, we certainly don't have such methods. We certainly don't have the capacity to do that, which means that something else is happening. There's something much more subjective going on, that there's a kind of different task that's not simply objectively reconstructing the past. And so then the question is, well, what is that task? And how does it relate to what Christians have always been doing when they try to look back and understand Jesus?
All right. Very interesting. So could you give me a couple of signs that this historical Jesus enterprise is not a pure science? Any sort of evidence to uncover that?
Of course. So one of the big ones would be, if something is a pure science, then the point of those methods is to remove our subjectivity so that we can objectively get at the reality, right? And that means that they should be repeatable. So if four different people with completely different backgrounds and beliefs and all of that all apply the same methods to the same data, they should all get the
it's
same
like in
results.
A science lab, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Like we're trying to do an experiment on whether, I don't know, whether some substance dissolves in some other substance. And if it's scientifically, if it's objective science, then it always happens, no matter who does it.
That's right.
The same substance dissolves in the same beaker, no matter who's doing it, no matter when they're doing it, no matter where they're doing it, always happens.
It always happens. Yeah. And so when we're capable of doing that, we would say, okay, our method is working. So our subjectivity, in other words, who's doing the thing, doesn't impact the outcome. That's how you've gotten at something objective. Okay, so this is the case and these methods are working. So if this was a truly scientific discipline, then any scholar who employs these methods would get the same answers about Jesus, and that has never happened. So historical Jesus scholarship has been going on for centuries, and historical Jesus scholars disagree with each other about basically every major question. And the scholarship has kind of been repetitive and cyclical in terms of the same debates coming up around again and again, and different scholars sort of continuing these different things. People will sometimes refer to consensus. And there are some things that at certain points in history, we would say a bunch of scholars do seem to agree about this. But then that changes, and then in the next generation, they don't. And so over time, there has been no genuine consensus about most of the major questions. And actually, what we get is radically, radically different pictures of Jesus from all of these different scholars who are ostensibly using the same or similar methods.
That's very interesting. So one of the scholars who most listeners will have heard of is N.T. Wright, of course. And he's very, very famous in the common evangelical church context. And they know what his view of the historical Jesus is. But they might not know that his is just one view, right? That actually other New Testament scholars might disagree with him wildly, or some of them might agree with him. But his take on the historical Jesus doesn't represent the sort of universal position of all his New Testament scholars, right?
Exactly. So he has been really influential, and particularly he's been influential in giving an approach to the historical Jesus that has brought a lot of Christians into being interested in it, because it's much more palatable to them. It's much closer to what Christians have historically believed. And so I think, you know, one of the great things that Tom Wright has done is show Christians, like, these historical questions matter, and there are ways of approaching this that don't necessarily, you know, go against everything you believe. But it's worth noting that, you know, his certainly can't be called, like, the consensus view. The vast majority of historical Jesus scholars disagree with him about everything. And so he's giving you know, one particular approach to this.
Yeah, and I tend to think about these things sort of sociologically a little bit. So I think, why is it that everyday Christians have heard of N.T. Wright and haven't heard of E.P. Saunders or John Dominic Crossan or whoever else in New Testament scholarship? Well, the reason is that N.T. Wright presents a view of the historical Jesus that fits traditional Christian tenets. N.T. Wright thinks that Jesus really was divine, that he really did die and rise again, and all these kinds of things. And so that's why Christians buy and read his books and not the books of the other New Testament scholars who don't think that, right?
I think that's right. I mean, obviously, also, N.T. Wright is an excellent writer. He's very compelling. He writes popular books and academic books. And so
he's
really
good at writing a popular level. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So he's really good at reaching a broad audience and bringing them in. But also, it is true, I think, especially the fact that his stuff is so widely read at confessional seminaries and these kinds of things, and then also in churches, is because he's giving us a Jesus who is much more in line with the Jesus that our traditions believe in. And so I think that is one of the biggest reasons why I think he's so widely read among Christians and not these other scholars.
Great. Can we move the conversation forward a little bit? So you said earlier that what you wanted to do is sort of, in this book, is you wanted to analyze this tradition of historical Jesus scholarship, but then you wanted to see how that relates to the sort of more traditional Christian position, and then think about how we as Christians might engage in historical Jesus scholarship without some of these sort of faulty or difficult presuppositions that more Orthodox Christians would be unhappy with. So what are some of your conclusions about that?
The way that I frame this is basically to say, if historical Jesus scholars have a bunch of presuppositions that they're bringing to this, a bunch of assumptions about what human persons are, what reality is, all of these kinds of things, then we should think of them as a tradition of historical inquiry, right? And so there's a kind of continuity among these scholars. They share a bunch of assumptions. And I'm thinking of tradition in kind of the way that Alistair McIntyre frames it. So not necessarily a theological tradition, but a kind of argument extended through time where fundamental agreements are defined and redefined by certain types
You're kind of joining a conversation, just like with every other academic discipline, right? When you get trained in, when you do an undergraduate degree in that discipline, you're joining a conversation. You have to read what people have written about that discipline before, and you sort of enter midway through that debate. And that's part of, that's what it means to be joining a tradition, the way you're describing it, right?
Yeah, that's right. And so, right, this isn't a kind of objective scientific thing we're doing, but we're rather entering into an ongoing conversation with certain assumptions, with certain focuses that's very located in a particular kind of culture and history. And that, so that we can sort of see in very substantial ways that historical Jesus scholarship and traditional Christianity are two rival traditions of historical inquiry. And so the other piece of that then is to say, actually, kind of classical Christology, what Christians have sort of confessed about Christ and how they think and talk about him, I think that counts as a genuine tradition of historical inquiry, a tradition that's deeply interested in Jesus as a historical figure, understanding him in his historical context, thinking critically about who he actually was. But they have different fundamental assumptions about reality that lead them to different conclusions about Jesus that are no less objective, no less sort of rigorous necessarily, but it's a very different conversation about how they get there. And so that's a lot of the book is sort of framing these two in those terms in order to open up a more fruitful dialogue where this isn't about sort of dogmatism from the Christian tradition and objectivity from the historians, but rather rival traditions who are trying to do similar tasks, needing
and
to figure
learn
out,
from each other, I guess.
To learn from each other, exactly.
Yeah.
So how can we, rather than having a kind of often combative relationship between these two, how can we open up fruitful dialogue between the two traditions so that they can learn from each other more deeply as we sort of seek the historical figure of Jesus?
Yeah, so if I can summarize where this argument has gone so far, you're basically, first of all, saying the historical Jesus tradition claims to be a kind of science, claims to be finding conclusions that are objectively valid regardless of who it is who's looking for them. But actually, if you look at it, they all disagree with each other. And so there isn't this sense that a particular position doesn't depend on the scholar doing the research. And so because of that, there's no reason to see traditional Christian views as disadvantaged, right? They're not sort of, if you start with the assumption that Jesus was actually divine, for example, you're not at a disadvantage over a historical Jesus scholar who doesn't start with that assumption. That's sort of what you're saying, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think one of the things that I argue is that it's not even so much about Jesus' divinity, but actually that Christian traditions of thinking about Jesus think that humans are a different thing than what contemporary historical Jesus scholars think humans are. And so both agree that Jesus was fully human. Christians confess Christ was fully divine and fully human. But even that fully human part is conceived of in very different ways than is conceived of in contemporary scholarship. And often that's the defense for historical Jesus scholarship is, hey, we believe Jesus was fully human, therefore he must have been XYZ, they'll say. And from a Christian perspective,
he must have thought like this, acted like this, had these desires, emotions, those kinds of things. Because exactly. That's what being a human means.
Yeah, yep. Okay. Yep. And so then those assumptions are then baked into their methods about therefore Jesus did this or didn't do that, said this or didn't say that, thought this or didn't think that. And then they reconstruct a different story about him. And so I argue, actually, those assumptions are A, not neutral, right? And B, not argued for by these scholars. Whereas the Christian tradition has really robust arguments for their views about what a human is. And they're much more explicit about those. And so in that sense, I think they're superior as a tradition because they have actually theorized these assumptions much more critically than the contemporary scholars have.
Very interesting. So this reminds me actually of the last episode that we did with Jesse Grenz on textual criticism of the New Testament, finding the original manuscripts, if there's such a thing as the original manuscripts, that kind of thing. Because one of the points that we arrived at in that episode is even this textual criticism, which is some of the most scientific or the most sort of basic part of New Testament studies, even that depends on certain understandings of what it means to be human, like what would a scribe be likely to forget to write, or what kind of mistakes would a scribe be likely to make, or what motivations would a scribe have to change the original text of the New Testament, which all sort of presupposes that I have an accurate understanding of what it means to be human that persists, that is true even of humans in the Middle Ages and of humans in Jesus' own time, right?
Yep, absolutely. And so I think that, and partly that's because Jesse and I did our PhDs together along with you, but we've talked quite a bit about these things. And so I think he's really aware of these kinds of questions in relation to his discipline as well as you are. But I think that this goes across historical method in general, and I'm kind of particularly engaging with how it touches ground in historical Jesus studies. But all historians are bringing these kinds of assumptions about human nature into the task that they're doing. I think it's particularly important and influential when it comes to thinking about Jesus, because they're doing much more theorizing fundamentally about kind of who and what he was in a way that they don't often with other historical figures.
It makes it feel a little bit circular, a little bit disorienting if you think about it that way, because I'm like, well, where do I get my understanding of what it means to be human from? Especially if I'm a Christian, I want to understand what it means to be human from Jesus. But if I'm trying to understand what Jesus said on the basis of my understanding of what it means to be human, then it feels like I'm trapped in some sort of circular reasoning there.
Yes, and I think this is a fascinating piece of this question. Because on the one hand, what I think is important to say is that, again, there is no neutral or objective ground from which to define what a human is. I certainly believe that philosophically, and we could have those debates about rationalism and such. But if that's true, one of the things that Christianity has done is said, as we think about what the historical claims being made by the texts of, say, the Gospels and the New Testament, when we think critically about that, we also open up the possibility that what they're saying to us changes our view of reality.
Yeah. Right?
That's a possible outcome, is that we could say, actually, maybe this is true about reality. Now, that's not necessarily a foregone conclusion always, but it's a possibility at least for Christian thinkers. It's not a possibility for contemporary historians. So they're coming in and saying, I already know what reality is. I already know what humans are from who knows where they got that. Maybe they thought about it critically. Maybe they just got it from their culture. Therefore, this text has to fit into that picture that I already have. And so I'm going to retell the story until it fits. That's one of the big differences, I think, between these two, what I'm calling traditions of historical inquiry.
I see. So the traditional Christian view actually takes seriously the depiction that Jesus gives us of what it means to be human and then reapplies that to our understanding of Jesus. So it sort of in some ways, it doesn't quite break out of that circular reasoning, but it enlarges the circle, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. That's, yeah. And so it's not entirely circular because Christians make philosophical arguments about human nature that are not purely based on, say, the New Testament. There's a mm-hmm. rational sort of grounding to the claims being made, but it's a rational grounding that then is in conversation with these historical texts and with a Christian tradition as it develops. And so what it's doing is it's allowing the Gospels a place within that kind of hermeneutical circle of reasoning, whereas these other traditions are not allowing these texts a place in their kind of circle of reasoning. Other things are being privileged to the exclusion of this.
That sounds very compelling. It actually reminds me of a quote by G.K. Chesterton about the differences, but the difference between actual science and humanities as different subjects, right? Because in science, you're studying, you know, objective things. You're studying the objective world around you. Whereas when you're doing a humanities subject, you're actually studying yourself. And there's a completely different toolkit you need in order to think about yourself. And he says, someone can understand astronomy only by being an astronomer. They can understand entomology, that's the study of insects, only by being an entomologist, or perhaps an insect. But they can understand a great deal of anthropology merely by being a person. They are themselves the animal which they study. And so he's basically saying you need a different set of skills to do any humanities subject. That's like philosophy or history or theology or whatever, literature, all of those humanities subjects, because you're turning around and looking at your own soul and your own spirit, as it were, which is just not the same thing as when you're analyzing chemicals in a bottle or something like that.
Yes, and this is, I think, brilliantly gets at one of the really key questions underlying this whole thing, which is history a science or is it part of the humanities? Because if history is a science, then what it's trying to do is give us objective facts about the past that we can use for, say, political or social ends. Mm. If it's a humanities discipline, then it's putting human beings into contact with reality from the past so that they themselves might be changed. And that means that when they engage with texts from the past, if it's a humanities discipline, then part of that is allowing the possibility that those texts are going to change what they think reality is, what they think truth is, what they think goodness is, how they see themselves as humans. Is that a possibility that's open? And one of the problems with the way that historical Jesus scholarship has been done, and a lot of, I think, contemporary historical criticism, is actually this idea that when we look at the past, we already know objectively what reality is, what truth is, what we are. And we're then judging the past in order to determine the facts about what did or didn't happen. And so it sets us up as historians with, I think, more authority than we have, more objectivity than we have, more assurance of actually what we know and what is true and what isn't than we can actually know, and cuts us off from the possibility that by engaging with these things from the past, our views might be transformed. And this isn't just for the Bible. So I think to do this consistently, we also would say, right, any text from the past, what does it look like to have a kind of openness that they're maybe telling us something about reality that we haven't grasped yet? I think that kind of is a big question underlying these more kind of precise things that I'm engaging with in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember learning about how the word science didn't used to mean what it means now. You know, now we have this neat division between the sciences, biology, chemistry, physics, astronomy, and the humanities. But, you know, in the 19th century, Germany, all of those things were called sciences because they were all aiming at this sort of objective facts. History was a set of objective facts that you just determined using an objectively valid method.
Yep.
And so this sort of modern division that we have between sciences and humanities wasn't there when these disciplines of history and biblical studies and New Testament scholarship were actually being born.
That's right. And so what's interesting about that is if we look back at the development of modern historical methods, which are being used by historical Jesus scholars, they're being developed in exactly that context, which itself is has a very strong and particular set of philosophical assumptions, right? We're talking about German idealism, and they're very open about that at that point, right? So those scholars are saying, this is what we believe to be the case about knowledge, about reality, about metaphysics and ontology, all these big kind of philosophy words.
Yeah.
They're theorizing that and then saying, therefore, history is this. But when we move into the 20th century, a lot of biblical scholars receive the methods from them without mm-hmm. the kind of underlying philosophical reflection about what's being assumed in those methods. And then they just continue to apply them. And this is where I take issue with someone like N.T. Wright, is that mm-hmm. I think he sometimes receives those methods just as they are and then has the kind of will to push them toward historical Christian orthodoxy. And he thinks that that's the only problem, is that we need to choose to use them in a way that aligns better with our theology. Whereas I'm saying, actually, the methods have sort of problems built into them, and we need to ask deeper questions about the methods themselves yeah. before we use them.
I mean, effectively, when you read N.T. Wright, he's sort of saying, well, I'm just applying these scientific methods better than everybody else, which is why you can trust my depiction of Jesus over and above these other scholars, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So can I ask for a little personal twist on this book and your own sort of journey into understanding why this matters? Why did you want to do this research, and how did you come across it, or how did you grow into thinking that it was really important for your faith and for other people's faith?
Thanks for that question. It's a very meaningful project for me. I began thinking about this 10 years ago. I was taking New Testament with Rick Watts at Regent College, where we both studied.
Good old Rick Watts, yeah.
Yep, and he had us read N.T. Wright's book, The New Testament and the People of God. And I loved it. I was obsessed. And so I bought basically all of other N.T. Wright's other books and just started devouring them in my free time. And the next book in that series is Jesus and the Victory of God. It's his book on historical Jesus studies. And near the end of that book, he says Jesus didn't know he was God. And he goes on sort of unpacks this. But yeah, he says, at least he says he didn't know he was God in the way that one knows one is male or female or hungry or whatever, that kind of thing. And so I circled that.
I didn't know N.T. Wright said that. Wow.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So I circled that and thought, I have no idea what to do with this. Is that true? Is that a problem? Is that... I never thought about it before. And then I annoyingly asked every professor after that in class, anytime we got anywhere close to that question, did Jesus know he was God? How do we know this? What do you think? And sometimes they, you know, had answers. Sometimes they're like, what are you talking about? But in Hans Boersma's class, I asked him, and he said, you know, Thomas Aquinas has this whole big section about Jesus' knowledge and how he knew things, and from a Christological perspective, what Christians think about that. Maybe you should read that. Which is sort of funny, because we know that Hans isn't the biggest fan of Thomas Aquinas, but he sort of set me on my journey of reading Thomas. And at the same time, I was asking, there was a couple of big debates going on at Regent and sort of in my own thinking. One was, what's the relationship between biblical scholarship and systematic theology?
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the time, those were very separate disciplines at Regent, and they were debating and arguing with each other a lot about who was being biblical and who was more Christian and how we do these things. And I loved what was happening in both of those spheres, but I couldn't fit them together. I felt like mm-hmm. they were at war, and I know you had a very similar experience.
Yes, I did.
And so that was very, you know, it was a kind of existential thing for me. I was like, I want to do both of these things, but I feel like I can't. And the other thing that for me was happening was that I got interested in theology from reading Karl Barth. So I was very strong Barthian, wrote my undergrad thesis on Barth.
20th century German theologian, one
That's
of the
right,
most influential
yes.
scholars of the 20th century.
Yeah, Protestant theologian. And one of the big things that, kind of a fundamental assumption of Barth is basically a kind of rejection of metaphysics. And so he's the way that sort of philosophy and theology relate, he's really wary of kind of the claims, a lot of the claims of philosophy, and he wants to do a theology that's sort of separate from that. And so that's how I came into theology. But then I was really interested in philosophy, and I was engaging a lot with the patristic tradition and a lot of theologians who use philosophy throughout their theology. And so that question was also going on in my head, and I was becoming increasingly dissatisfied with Barth's approach. And
it's
so,
just a wholesale rejection of philosophical categories, right? He's just like, these things can be dangerous, like, or influences or away from the truths of the Christian faith.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I mean, my reading of Barthes is that he's, you know, it's very kind of post-Kantian. So he has these assumptions about what we can know and how we know things. And basically yeah. that a lot of philosophy is stuff that we can't know anyways. And so we shouldn't talk about it. And so, I was becoming kind of dissatisfied with that as well. And so all of these cohered around this question of theological method. How do we engage with scripture? How do we do theology? And what's the role of philosophy in that? And then mm-hmm. the question of Jesus' knowledge, I realized, is really at the heart of all these things. Because what historians are asking is, who did Jesus think he was? What did Jesus intend to accomplish with his characteristic actions? And mm-hmm. how can we tell a story about that? Which assumes questions about knowledge, but also that assumes philosophical questions about what humans are, what knowing is, all of that kind of thing. And so for me, I realized all of these big things that I'm wrestling with are cohering on this one question.
Yeah.
And so that kind of gave birth to the project.
That's amazing. So one final question, and then we'll wrap up. Let's assume that some ordinary church goer who's not studied theology, they buy your book, they read it, and they think, this is great. And they get to the end of the book, and then they think, well, now what? How does this change my faith? How does this change how I read the Bible? How do I take this forward? What do I do now?
Yeah, well, first of all, I don't know that I would necessarily recommend someone who has no theological training to buy my book, because it's expensive and they'll find it very dense. It's written for scholars, so
yeah.
I would love to write a book that's
a good caveat. Is,
yeah. more digestible for people, but it's, you know, it uses all the specialized language and stuff. But if they did, or if they had a friend who did and they talked about it, there are kind of two major takeaways. So one is that they will probably come across a lot in popular media about that the historians or the scholars have proven X, Y, or Z about Jesus, and therefore Christians are wrong, and they shouldn't trust their traditions, they shouldn't trust their scriptures. And one thing that I think I show, and the scholars that I engage with show very well, is that that's not what's happening. The scholars have not proven very much, they don't agree on very much, and there are very, very big questions to be asked about the kinds of methods that they're using. And so that kind of certainty isn't fitting for the task of what they're doing, and Christians therefore shouldn't feel anxiety about what's coming out of that. But on the flip side, Christians really have important theological reasons to care deeply about historical questions around Jesus.
So we shouldn't just ignore all of that, yeah.
That's right. So I spend a lot of the book also proving, if you affirm, say, a classical Chalcedonian Christology, then you need to do history, good critical history, in order to understand Jesus well. And so that means we don't just say, oh, let's ignore scholarship, let's ignore history. You know, we just do with Jesus what we want, read the Bible however we want on our own, that kind of thing. But actually, if we care about Jesus, if we want to actually understand what he had to say to us, then we need to engage well and critically with history. But do we that with the kind of open hand that says, right, this scholarship isn't a science. And so what can we learn from it positively? And I give some sort of, I think, insights about how we might do that better. But those would be the two things that I would hope people might take away practically from it.
That's amazing. And I guess there's no doubt that this has helped you on your own faith journey to sort of reconcile all of these sort of seemingly contradictory claims and positions into a sort of way that you can confidently put your trust in what the New Testament says about Jesus and learn about what it means to be human and about how we're to live from that.
Absolutely. Yeah, it has. And I'm really grateful for the chance to think about all these things and write about all these things. And one of the places that it's landed me is to say that part of how I think human thinking and learning works is that we come to inhabit traditions of thought. And then from that stance, engage critically with other traditions of thought. And that the subjectivity of our knowledge isn't a problem, it's just part of being human. That should open up a space where we can actually dialogue a lot with people from different traditions and have rival views, and sort of open up a space of kind of positive engagement with them. That I think has been a really important outcome for me, is just more and more capacity to engage positively with people of really different views. Rather than this sense of we have to prove objectively who's right and wrong and enforce that on everybody. It sort of opened up a space of kind of openness and wonder and to engage with other people.
It's So we've got lots to talk about. We've got lots to dialogue with people, even if we disagree with them on stuff. We can learn a lot and benefit a lot just by dialoguing, just by talking through the issues. Yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, congratulations on the publication of this, your first book.
That's right. It is my first book. Yeah, thank you so much. It's exciting to see it out in the world with a life of its own now.
Well, I look forward to seeing what is done with it and how it transforms the world of theology.
Yeah, so hopefully at least start some good critical, constructive conversations between historians and biblical scholars.
Thank you for listening to Faith at the Frontiers, a podcast that confronts challenges to the Christian faith with hope. If you liked this episode, then do subscribe to hear more like it in the future. For now, goodbye.